Billy. In the garbage. Right into the freaking garbage.
You see that crap? All that horror crap? Things coming out of crates, people, dead people coming back to life, people turning into weeds, for Christ's sake. I never saw such rotten crap in my life. Where do you get this shit? Who sells it to you? All that horror crap?
What you know about chemicals? You don't know what chemicals. What you know about chemicals? You don't know what chemicals.
You don't even know what the fuck is in store for that bitch ass of yours. Let me get a look at that bitch ass of yours. There it is. It looks like a bitch's ass. You bitch ass motherfucker.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this very special edition of DWN Productions THC Podcast, sponsored by Fast Custom Shirts on this, the Horrorphilia Podcast Network. And I don't know if you can hear that, but one of the dogs is trying to get in on the conversation in the back. Joe, special episode. Why don't you tell everybody about it?
Hey, everybody. So this is going to be one of the first... I consider it a major interview that we've had on the show, and we're speaking with Howard Wexler, who he's been all over the place. He's been cinematographer for years and years to this day. He's still doing the job, and we're going to talk to him about his storied career, some of the people he's worked with, and a lot of you are fans of the same type of movie we are, so you're going to recognize a lot of the titles we're talking about.
All right, so Howard, how are you doing today, man?
I'm good. Thank you very much for that beautiful introduction.
Oh, no worries. Thank you for being here. Like I told you before, we appreciate it for sure.
Without, I didn't know I was that a major of an interview, but that's cool. That's okay.
We'll get to that.
Well, okay. We have two. We have you and we have Fred Williamson. So I think you're a good company.
Right, okay.
So, first off the bat, this is, I think, the most important question you're going to be asked today, and that is, how much do you know about September 9th, 2009?
That's funny. Well, there might have been an invasion that day.
You don't say. What was this invasion about?
That was a little movie a buddy of mine wrote, and yes, and he didn't want to direct it, so I stepped in, and it's on Amazon Prime. It's not a great movie. I think it looks okay, and the directing is okay. I'm proud of what we gave the editor in 10 days. It's a Lachlan...
Monroe.
I forgot his last name. Monroe. Does a great job as playing, you know, a small town sheriff, and there's some weird stuff that goes on in this little town. Several of the actors whom I cast, who were unknown at the time, have gone on to do great work in Hollywood. And unfortunately, our effects fell a little short. When people promise you stuff and they don't deliver, you know, it happens, but you just got to scramble a little bit. But Infection, The Invasion Begins, was a movie I directed in 2009, I believe.
Yes.
Okay.
And I did watch that last night, maybe early this morning, actually on Amazon Prime. And my one question about it was how hard was it finding pants to go with the cop's uniform?
Mm. Right. Well, this is Hollywood, you know, and if you want a pink elephant to come down the street in the next 2 minutes or next 2 hours, it can be done. You know, just make some phone calls, and anything you can think of is here in Hollywood or can be made or manufactured. So right we had a good wardrobe lady.
I watched part of this movie earlier today too, and you're right, there's a lot of recognizable faces that people may not know their names right off the bat, but once you see them, and, oh yeah, that person from this and this and this. But yeah. My question to you about the film is here you're working with somebody else. Somebody else has handed the cinematography chores. What was that like for you?
Well, that was my buddy Cameron. And Cameron was my assistant for many years. And I thought he could just take over shooting. You know, we didn't make it very fancy. We made it fairly simple cinematography, concentrating maybe a little more on the lighting. It was shot with my Panasonic HD camera at the time. And if you notice it, if you turn off the sound and just watch it from a editing or cinematography point of view, you'll notice that we always let a character enter the frame or exit the frame. And that sort of helps a low-budget movie pick up momentum and have some pace to it. So when I watched it recently on Amazon Prime on a big screen, I said, oh, wow, that's interesting blocking. You know, there's one scene in the jail that goes on. It's got four or five characters in it, and it's a oneer, and it does 180 twice, and it tells the story within one shot. And I thought that was effective. So little things like that, you know, sort of make your day when you're trying to get a lot of locations and work in on a small budget. And it was fun. Cameron has gone on to become his own cinematographer, working a second unit a lot in Los Angeles. So I'm proud of him for making that leap.
Right on. And I mean, getting all those shots, and I'm sure that was the only one. Watching the whole movie, there were a lot of interesting shots in the thing, and shooting in 10 days, that's quite an accomplishment to get done for sure.
Yeah. Mary Kate Shellhart, who was the 6 or 12 year old girl in Gilbert Grape, I've always loved her work, and I she was great to work with, and she hasn't done much since. She's sort of doing other things right now, but I really liked what she did in the movie. The last day we were in the rain, which I thought was apropos for that scene. We just put a little pop-up tent over the camera and shot the scene. All of the locations I picked myself, and they were totally within the 30-mile zone of here in L.A., and much of it was in a house in the Hollywood Hills with an empty lot across the street. We didn't tie the two together, but the UFO apparently lands in the empty lot, which was about a 10-second walk from a big Hollywood Hills house.
Right on.
So I guess we're kind of taking this for granted, but we should probably, if you could explain to the people listening in that don't know, what exactly is the job of a cinematographer? Where does your day start and end on set, and just a basic overall of what you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, my job basically in one sentence is to capture the imagery that tells the story of that moment. Okay, so that's a really simplified, although complicated, way of saying that it's my job to help the director tell the story.
Okay.
I have to help or suggest to the director where to put the camera and why. Okay, very important little sentence, where to put the camera and why. So if anybody in the audience watches a movie, turn off the sound and just think about, well, why did Orson Welles put the camera there, and why? And why does Spielberg do that, and why? How is it telling the story of that beat, of that moment? Not the entire story. We're talking about, you know, just a little sliver of the story. So my job is to know where the sun is at all times, when the sun is going to come up if we're on an all-nighter, how many lights we have in our lighting package, what's our crew capabilities, am I working with experienced people, or should I not get anybody electrocuted and keep it kind of simple? Of course, nowadays on a camera, it's much different than the Sidaris days. In Sidaris, we were shooting with an Aeroflex film camera, which had an on-off switch. On the lens was an f-stop and a focus. That was it. Okay. So nowadays, on any digital camera, you've got, you know, a 30-page menu that you've got to deal with, plus memory time. So the job of the cinematographer is to support the director in getting the imagery that tells the story.
Yeah, it makes sense. And most people just say, yeah, they just take the picture. They're just there to make sure everything's caught on film or on sticks or whatever you're using. But no, there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, most people who don't know what a cinematographer does, also known as a director of photography, the two words are interchangeable, are flabbergasted when they come onto a set and see that me as the DP, I never sit down. There's no time for that. There's always the next set to worry about. Not to worry about, I'm not a worrier, but the next set to prep, tomorrow to prep, crew to keep happy and invigorated and excited about the project, which is a real, real big challenge these days. A lot of people on crew sit around and surf their phones, but on the Sidaris crew or on any crew that I'm on, people are standing, no coffee, no cigarettes, no phones, and everybody's working together as a unit, as a family, because there's a lot that goes on. There's safety to consider. There's the speed of the day. There's the actresses or actors' comfortable aspect. So it sort of goes on and on. And I guess you might call me a senior person. I tend to be one of the older folks on the set these days.
Experience.
Experience, yes. And you know, I don't flaunt that. Everybody's got great ideas no matter what their age. But sometimes it's experience that helps you make the day safely, get the page count done, make the actors look great, and producer happy, which is the most important thing.
For sure. Well, this is supposed to be part of the Summer of Sidaris we're doing on the podcast, and you brought him up. So how actually did you get involved with him and start shooting him? Mm-hmm. The first one you were on was Malibu Express, and that was his first one in the series?
Yes, that was Andy's first one in the series, a fairly decent budget. And I actually replaced another DP on their third day. So I was brought to the set by a friend of mine who was on the picture at that time. I was shooting on the Sunset Strip, and I observed what they were doing. I saw their equipment package. And the next day I was in the Marina del Rey, California. We're filming on the boat that plays prominently in the movie, including the very last scene. So my first day... This was not my first feature, but it was my first sort of one that I was nervous about because I had heard about Andy and my friend was the line producer on it, and it was a big deal, and there was money at stake, and Hefner was interested in seeing the dailies because Hugh Hefner was a friend of Andy. So it was a little bit of nervous time to be on a boat in the marina, all with all windows, with no HMIs. HMIs weren't not even invented at the time. There was no daylight lighting except for a glass unit you could put over a light or a piece of gel or something. And here we are inside this sort of cramped boat. And the camera was, like I said, an Aeroflex 2C, which was built in 1949, maybe, just after the war. It was a World War II combat camera made by Aeroflex and sort of upgraded. But it was noisy. And it had three lenses on the front, the three turret front, with a 400-foot magazine. And sometimes, yeah, you could only put a 400-foot magazine on, but it was noisy. So it had to go inside a lead blimp. And that lead blimp, which is not in use anymore, was a sound silencer for this camera. And the lead blimp was maybe 60 pounds, and it went on a Cine 60, an O'Connor 50 head, which is a very small tripod head. So, and to pull focus, there was a hole in the side of the blimp where a mechanism with a gearing device would stick out the side of it, and that's how an assistant would pull focus. Fortunately, the assistant had worked with Andy before and knew the gear. He really wasn't a qualified AC, but he was a great assistant who also became the editor of the film. It was a whole family affair. But that Cine 60 blimp was a rental, and Andy owned the Aeroflex, which I think he shot a movie called Stacy with a few years before, which was shot by John Alonzo, ASC, very famous DP, whom I had the pleasure of talking to one day when he called Andy to say hello on the set. So learning or using all my knowledge to figure out how to light a daylight interior on a boat with slow speed film. In that days, the film stock was maybe ASA 125. That's tungsten. And then it would be 64 daylight. Nowadays, we're talking 800 ASA, or exposure index. And back then, it was 64. So we needed, you know, quite a bit of light. Andy's lighting package for that shoot consisted of open-face quartz lights. And there might have been some Fay lights, F-A-Y, which were 1,000-watt or 600-watt globes, which had a blue sort of paint over the front, which turned that into daylight. So hell, man, what I loved about working with Andy, I learned a ton. I learned a ton right from the first moment, you know, and luckily I was up for it and could handle it. The rest of the movie, sort of a family affair. It was Arlene and Drew Sedaris was the second AD, or first AD, actually, and some other people. And we just had this script. It might have been 30 pages long, if it was that long. and not that it was all ad-libbed, you know, because Andy was so brilliant at these lines of that were, I don't want to say stupid, but they were campy and they were funny and they were, Andy was a smart man. You know, he directed, he's got many, many Emmys for directing collegiate football. And then he won an Emmy for one of the Olympics when he was there and masterfully technical directed from the truck the USA winning the hockey event, winning gold, I believe it was, or losing gold. I forget which one. But Andy was—he was used to sitting in a truck, looking at 40 monitors and knowing which one to cut to instantly. So it would be like, take 6, go 7, go to 8, 9, dissolve to 12. So he had a really spontaneous, quick mind.
That's interesting to hear. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's interesting to hear. Given the titles that he's famous for, without hearing that, I would just think he's a guy that had money, wanted to make movies and surround himself with beautiful women. Was that part of the case in doing these Lethal Ladies series of films?
Andy used to get so embarrassed when one of the playmates or one of the girls was close. In every love scene or shower scene, Andy would hide, basically. And it was up to me, eventually, because we never had videotape. Videotape was not invented for low budget until that we could handle. It was invented by Jerry Lewis way back in the late 70s, but we could never really have a small enough monitor. Flat screens didn't exist. If you know, we just didn't have video playback or video tap. So after a take, Andy would say, How was it? My short name was Hal on the set. You know, instead of two syllables, it was one syllable. Hey, how was it? Andy would look through the lens at the beginning of the shot and the end of the shot, and he'd know what the millimeter was. We only had four lenses, 25, 50, an 85, and sometimes we carried a 10 to 100 zoom, and then second unit would always have a 25-250, which is a very long lens, very slow. You really couldn't use it indoors, but outdoors, it was great. But Andy made sure that Arlene was never within sight of one of the girls when we were half-dressed. He was just, you know, he was had a Christian upbringing, Greek Orthodox. And even though he loved the babes and he always walked around with his shirt untucked, so you saw his sort of big chest and oversized belly, he just loved women for what they were. And there's nothing more beautiful than a half-naked woman taking a shower on the beach in Hawaii. But Andy would get embarrassed by that. Although everybody knew that that's why we were making the movie. We had a rule that one of the girls had to take a shower or a hot tub every reel. Now, in a feature film, that's at least once every 10 minutes. And that's a formula that holds through most of the movies, I believe. You know?
Yes, so, once every half reel. Got it.
Okay. So, after all, they're on the one sheet, they're in the trailer, they're half-dressed, and they're playmates. So why not exploit is the bad, wrong word, but why not make use of their talents? Their talents, you know, visually, and sometimes they really couldn't pronounce a sentence correctly, but Andy helped them through that. So it was just a lot of fun most of the time. Sometimes, you know, we would get bogged down with something, a special effect would not work, or we didn't have an adequate meal, especially on a lonely island. We had very little camera problems because we always took care of it well, even though we were out in the sun and the sand. Oddly enough, Andy never liked to move the camera unless it was in a boat, a car, or an airplane. I think in Malibu Express, I tried to get him to use a dolly, a little doorway dolly. That's something you put the tripod on, and it's got wheels on four sides, and you pull it. And there's a shot of Sybil Danning coming through doors late in the picture, and the camera pulls back with her quickly. And I thought that was apropos of Sybil Danning. She's such a fox, and she was dressed in leather, and she's got this great walk. And just to keep her in the scene longer than just panning with her or a telephoto looking at her, I thought, come on, Andy, this is a great spot. Let's pull back with the dolly. Well, the shot's in the movie, but Andy hated it, and we never did a dolly shot again. Okay. So... anytime the camera moves a lot when it's in an airplane, car, or boat.
you have any wild stories about shooting on any of those vehicles? Because, I mean, it's not like shooting on the ground.
Well, is it Picasso Trigger or Return to Savage Beach when the two girls, Hope and Marie, those are their real names, Hope Marie Carlton and forgotten their name. Oh, son of a gun. They're flying in an airplane in a storm as part of their mission at night in a Cessna 172. Okay, so it's a great scene. It's awesome. And of course, they're wet because they just ran through the rain to get to the airplane. So they have to change their tops, right? They have to take off their wet tops.
Of course.
Put on something dry. Of course. So anyway, we filmed that on the ground at Victorville Airport, which is out in the desert in California. We had a little smoke machine. We had a hose. We had a little wind effect. And I'm hand-holding the camera, I believe, or maybe it was on sticks outside one of the doors, watching the two ladies fly the airplane. But it was poor man's process, as we call it. A couple of guys are rocking the airplane. The girls are acting and moving around a little bit. And then it cuts to the ninth hole of the golf course at the Sheraton in Molokai, which is an island in Hawaii. And a qualified pilot lands the plane on the ninth green through a fountain of water that the hotel was nice enough to open a fire hydrant for us and provide a hose. So it's a great cheat, but it's awesome. And while we're on that subject, before I get into cars and boats, you know, on every Andy movie, we would go to Kmart or Target and buy a couple of plastic plants. And these plants were in every movie. And they're standing high. They're about 4 or 5 feet high. I think we shipped them to Hawaii. We might have left them there. And if you notice, for any foreground or in the background to hide something, we'd move in a fern. These are plastic ferns. And you could bend the leaves any way you wanted to. You know, we might have had a fir tree, a small fir tree. Nothing higher than, you know, 4 feet, because we'd have a couple of apple boxes to put them on. So the little cheats of props is the genius of Andy. We did have on Malibu Express, we did have a script supervisor, Steve Gerke. And on Malibu and other pictures, if you look closely at the IMDb page for those pictures, you'll find that on the technical side, almost everybody has gone on to do great work in Hollywood. Mm. I chose my friends for Malibu and the other pictures, and they were camera assistants and lighting guys. And now two of those people are ASCDPs. Marshall Adams shot Felicity. He did Grimm. He's all kinds of TV shows, NCIS. A great DP in his own right, and he pulled focus back in the day when I was working with Sedaris. Todd Dos Reis, ASC, one of the few really great up-and-coming African-American cinematographers, working all the time. He did years of handheld work on TV, and now he's doing a lot of episodic work. The gaffer on that show was John Vecchio, who has remained a gaffer ever since for the last almost 40 years, doing really big time work in Hollywood as a gaffer. And oddly enough, he married the camera assistant on Malibu Express, whom I connected the two of them on that picture, Irene, and they've got two kids and, you know, live happily ever after kind of thing.
Right on.
Yeah. There's a scene in... Yeah, go ahead.
No, please. Continue.
I was just going to move to another scene. I forget whether it's, I think it's in Malibu Express, where there's a boat chase through the bayous.
Yes.
So Andy grew up in Louisiana, and we kept going back to Louisiana because it's a right to work state. You can get a really decent meal for $5, probably still to this day. You didn't really need a shooting permit. He knew people there, and it was like coming home. So we would drive our gear in a van to Shreveport and base out of Shreveport. And so there's a boat chase, and I'm in the boat, and Voya, who was handing me the camera from our support boat, his hands were quite big. And it's Shreveport in summer, and it's like 110, and the humidity is 100%. And so the tape that I had taped on the lens to hold the f-stop where I wanted it fell off. And it fell off during the time that I'm receiving the camera in this race boat. So if you look at that scene, I'm shooting it with a zoom lens, handheld, in the back of this really fast little low sleek boat going through the trees of this bayou on Lake, I think it's called Clear Lake or Lake Charles outside of Shreveport. Lake Charles. Everything in that scene is two stops dark. My mistake. But it's an exciting scene. I didn't tell anybody. We screwed up. You know, I was embarrassed. It's not something you want to shoot again. So I learned my lesson that way. And that was the boat experience. Cars were always, there's a big safety issue with cars then and now. And it was always, sometimes we'd have a pickup day where Andy and Drew and I and maybe one other person would go out to the desert and just get some shots of a wheel or a car or little inserts that we didn't have time to get on the day that we were shooting. I don't think we ever did a car mount. You know, everything in Malibu Express when the border scene, that all of that work is car to car. I'm handheld in the chase car or the next car or probably out the side of the van. The production van had a sliding door and we'd open it, and I'm in there probably handheld. In that scene is also a long shot of the Jeep coming over the crest, and Andy found a fantastic road, and we get there. Nobody there, and we set up one camera with the 25-250, and that's the long telephoto shot of that Jeep coming up the hill. Airplanes were a lot of fun for me because I love flying, and we had a really qualified pilot that we found in Hawaii, I think, and this guy never shut up talking. Because he always had a story to tell. And we're flying around, and we take the door off. I'm strapped into the front seat, and that's how I get the air-to-air shots of the other plane flying around Molokai. Beautiful shots with the North Coast Pali cliffs in the background.
Yeah.
This pilot was always talking about how he was running drugs for George Bush in South America. And, you know, it's such a tall story. You didn't know whether to believe him or not. Back in those days, we would steal shots. I think it's on a YouTube little training tape at the end, training video at the end, where we jump out of a van in front of the Honolulu airport and get a shot of Cody Abilene or one of the girls getting into a car, making a getaway. No permits. It happened in about 12 seconds. So I have to be on my game, you know. I got to whip out the light meter. I got to see where it is. I'm looking at the clouds because clouds in Hawaii are changing every 5 seconds. Somebody's on the lookout for security. We have the picture car right there. The girl jumps in, drives off, and I get a shot, a bonus shot of the tower or the where it says Honolulu. And then we all go meet at the McDonald's close by and say, wow, we got it. Let's celebrate. You know, so lots of little stories like that. We stole shots in Shreveport and all over the place. But the Cessna, I always, I had done some previous helicopter work, and I knew that there's a lot of vibration. So my rule then was to always use a hotel pillow on my lap. And a hotel pillow tend to be pretty new, so they absorb a lot of vibration. And I think that's how we got those shots air to air.
Smart thinking.
Smart or stupid or whatever, you know, the door's open, I'm in with a seatbelt. Of course, we put grip tape around the latch of the seatbelt.
You're hugging the pillow, so you'll be fine.
Yeah, right. And on one of those trips, I'm with and the two of my grip guys or two of the guys on the crew are in the back seat along for the ride, just because it was a thrill to fly around Molokai in an open door Cessna. But we're coming in for a landing at Honolulu Airport, pretty empty by then in those days. And this pilot who was flying drugs for George Bush said, okay, I'm going to slip it in. Watch this, guys. And he mumbled something to the tower. And then all of a sudden, we're doing this steep dive adjacent to the runway. And he pulls a 180 100 feet off the deck and lands the plane. And that was a thrill that I've never forgotten him almost 40 years later. Okay, I've talked for a while. What questions do you have?
Well, Howard, one of the staples of these films is the use of radio control vehicles. Did you become an enthusiast for RC vehicles as well during the filming?
Yeah, those were awesome and usually built by somebody. I love the helicopter one. Helicopter was great. The little toys that come out of a suitcase and, you know, eventually get blown up. In Malibu, I think it is, we blew up something in downtown park in Louisiana. It's the one that goes between the bad girl's legs and then she blows up. Yeah. Oh, no, it goes the other way. She sends it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we had the fire department standing by. And a tree caught on fire because of that explosion. Of course, we have an effects guy, and it doesn't happen in the same shot. That's tricky editing to put those two shots together. I think the little remote goes up a ramp and into a car, and then the car explodes. For whatever reason, we're in a public park. The fire department is there. They're stoked. They're about five guys in uniform, and they are stoked to get autographs and to see us filming, because I guess it was a slow day. And a tree catches on fire because of our explosion. And the fire department gladly put it out, but they had such a good time that it was amazing. Everybody got a huge chuckle out of the whole event. There's a great animatronic snake that is world famous now because of the snake scene, you know, and that was done animatronically in a studio in Hollywood. And my good friend, the production designer for many of Andy's movies, Sal Grasso, and he's the person I met the first day. And the scene where they're loading guns in that cabana, which is supposed to be Hawaii, but it's really Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. I said, Sal, this is pretty flat. Can we get a rotating fan? And I'll just send a light through it, and we'll have some energy to the scene. And you don't see the fan in the in any of the shots, but you know it's there, and you have a much better feel for Hawaii, because every room in Hawaii has a rotating fan. And that, right? And that fan is going throughout the scene as they're loading their weapons. And then she crawls over to the toilet, and then, you know, history was made.
Yeah, that the snake scene coming out of the toilet with the dude coming through the wall and then blowing it up with a rocket launcher, that has to be the internet's favorite Andy Sedaris moment.
Yeah. Well, that's Andy's genius, to combine on-set Hollywood with what we were going to build, or what we had built in Hawaii. I forget which came first. You know, for many of those explosion scenes, there's a little camera called a IMO, which, again, was a Bell and Howell invention for World War II combat cameramen.
What did you say the name of the camera was again?
IMO, E-Y-M-O.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
And made by Bell and Howell. And it's a wind-up camera. So you wound it up, and you got maybe 30, 40 feet of a run. Sometimes you could get more than that, depending upon the camera. And actually, the first shot I ever did in Hawaii was with an IMO. It's where the dummy falls out of the high-rise building in downtown Honolulu and falls to his death. I'm on the ground with an IMO. This is you're not looking through the lens, you're looking through a viewfinder, and you're holding this thing, and it's like being in combat. So even though it had three lenses on the front, I have to follow this from a 12-story building. And the guy, or Andy, was up top. He wanted to throw the dummy out of a balcony along with a quantity of broken glass. So you see glass coming down. And I'm the guy who did that shot, and I nailed it on the first take. Hmm. Anyway, the IMO is something Andy owned, and we would put it into a blast housing, which is, again, a lead case with an opening for the lens. So we could get that close to any explosion, and it was triggered. You'd turn it on and run, and then the effects guy would blow it up. So sometimes the person who was running away, his back was to the explosion and didn't get to see it. The two other cameras were stationed nearby to get the explosion. And then sometimes we rent a Arri 3, which is a high-speed camera, not quiet, but noisy, that would film slow motion. So the slow motion shots when the helicopter blows up and all the little stunts happen, that's with a high-speed Aeroflex.
Right on.
I want to. Yes, I am. I do love remote control. yes, I do.
I want to shift gears a little bit. Emmanuel. Now, that's a name known to most of our listeners. Anybody that stayed up at night watching Cinemax back in the 80s had to have seen an Emmanuel film. Now, you got to work on three of these. Can you tell us a little about those films?
Well, I think I did Emmanuel, the movie, number three, was it? And then we did Emmanuel, the series. And both of them were shot at Roger Corman's old studio in Venice, California, which is now condos, which is a fantastic place to work, because there were three stages. And Roger was such a genius that a crew would work during the day on one movie, and somebody would come in at night and shoot another movie. and many people in Hollywood are graduated from the Corman School, including many well-known DPs. But Emmanuel, the series, I think, was a lot of fun. That was 16 millimeter, or maybe, yeah, 16 millimeter. And I sort of had invented by then the use of the jib arm, the jib, J-I-B, which is a way to move the camera. Even though Andy wasn't into moving, I was always, somehow my eye gravitated toward giving the audience interest, no matter what movie, by moving the camera subtly or radically up, down, right, left. And in those Emmanuels and another series we did down there, another R-rated Cinemax series, the A camera was I-operated and on a jib arm, and we did some really fantastic work photographically, I must admit. All of that work down there. Interestingly enough, you know, Andy's, the Sedaris movies are now distributed by Full Moon or on the Full Moon website. And I do a fair amount of work for Charlie Band, Mr. Full Moon. Mm-hmm. So it's 40 years later, it's kind of neat to see Andy movies on the website, as well as Blade and Puppet Master and some of the more recent Full Moon movies. And a few years ago, Charlie Band wanted to do a one-on-one with Roger Corman, which we did in Roger's office. And then see two of those guys, sort of Lloyd Kaufman notwithstanding, two of the West Coast geniuses of low budget and exploitation and even some sexploitation. That was a thrill to be in the room with those guys. So I don't remember too much about Emmanuel. I know the actress. I thought she had a great career ahead of her, but she didn't manifest to anything.
Really quick, how much time do you have left? Because it looks like I still have about a page of questions, and I don't want to hold you too long.
You're not. I'm actually enjoying this, Tom. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity. I hope you'll archive this and put it on a couple of backups so it doesn't disappear.
Oh, no, for sure. I just wanted to jump in.
I got plenty of time.
Okay,
cool. It's nice to reminisce.
Right on. Appreciate it. Okay, speaking of time, what was about the average shooting schedule? Like, how many days did you shoot? How long did you shoot? And was there time for the actor persons to learn their lines?
Mm-hmm. Well, Ron Moss came from TV, so he knew his lines. And you know what? Those lines are maybe three lines long at the most on an Andy movie, right?
Yes.
So there's not a great deal of homework that needs to be done on an Andy movie. You just got to get the makeup on and find the smallest swimsuit.
So would you say that his movies were made for swimsuit enthusiasts or people who need to learn how to take on and off their clothes?
I say these movies were made for the average American male.
For Al Bundy.
Yeah, who's with a fair amount of testosterone that's going on either side. Come on, you know, a female body is to be worshipped. And that's a sexist comment, I realize that, which is not politically correct these days, but we're talking about movies that were almost 40 years ago when we were just learning about our brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
So I think we were doing a public service. I still think sexploitation is doing a public service. Because
doing the Lord's work.
Doing the Lord's work, right. For those people who are not into demonstrating or voting or, you know, being otherwise good Americans. There's a lot of people who just like these kinds of movies because it's mindless entertainment, right? And we need some of that to shake off the evil in the world and the front page of the newspaper. You just need a belly laugh once in a while, and there's nothing like a Sedaris movie to give you that.
Exactly. That's the key word, entertainment. A lot of people seem to forget that that's the whole point. Make money, yes, but they're made to be entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. As far as our travel time, you know, Andy would fly every weekend to a college somewhere to do his – he made really good money, I'm sure, doing the technical director for ABC and ABC Wide World of Sports. So we have to stop shooting usually Thursday night, and Andy would come back Friday or Sunday afternoon. So our time schedule was working around Andy's schedule. I think our longest shoot time was 3 weeks, and that was allowing for – that's not including travel, because on the biggest show we went – Los Angeles, Honolulu, Molokai, Honolulu, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and Louisiana. And that's not including the 4 days that Andy and I, on the good graces of his Delta bonus miles, that Andy and I flew to Paris for those shots of the Eiffel Tower. And we took the license plate. And it's just Andy and me sitting in business class, sipping champagne, going to Paris, where I had to try and speak some French to get a camera out of the rental company and to tell our driver where we wanted to go. And we couldn't use walkies. So with a wave of the arm, the limo driver would drive the path that we sketched out for him. And the first take is in the movie. Come on, guys. I mean, that's genius. That's Andy putting these things together. Of course, he hated Paris. And all he wanted was a decent hamburger, and we could never find one. So he spent all his time in the hotel room and waiting for his flight to get back. But, you know, I had a good time. And that scene, the limo doesn't match 100%, but it's very close. But the license plate matches because we took it with us. and you believe that he drives up in front of the embassy in Paris or wherever it is, which is downtown Shreveport. So the 3 week thing is maybe the longest time. We took our time in Las Vegas, you know, and Andy shoot. Andy likes to eat. It might be just a ham sandwich, which is his favorite thing to offer anybody who walked through the front door. Hey, can I make you a ham and cheese sandwich? So, you know, we would have fairly decent sit-down meals, usually at the buffet in Las Vegas or the restaurant at the hotel in Molokai or some other little place. In Las Vegas, when we were out, in Henderson, which is where Tom Devlin lives, as a matter of fact, there was nothing out there. So all we ended up with was a $5 buffet line. And that was a little radical because it was obviously canned peas and canned this and that. And we were starving because we had out in the desert working, doing shots. You know, you get hungry and thirsty. So that was, the crew didn't like that meal. Many other times it was the mullet, it was McDonald's, because that's all we could get on the run. But the travel time for Andy was maybe 3 weeks at the max. And I just want to point out that there's a movie called Final Stab, directed by David Dakota.
Slasher movie?
It is sort of a slasher movie, but it was a full moon movie also.
Maybe early 2000s?
Yeah, Sounds about
right.
Yeah,
I think I've seen that.
20 years ago. That's a four-day feature. Okay, 4 days, we got a 90-minute movie. And that's because of me knowing how to move fast from my days with Sedaris, knowing what the coverage needed to be, knowing from my experience sitting in the editing room with Andy, and the genius of David Dakota, who directed that in 4 days. And those are 12-hour days. The last day went 13 hours because the wind came up. And we had a half day of prep because everything happens in the dark. So we had to tent the house that we were shooting in. So that took a half day. But the entire movie shot on a movie cam on a jib arm with a 1,000-foot magazine, which is a tremendously huge beast of a camera, and a Dutch head, because David Dakota liked to rock the camera back and forth. So my experience, there's the experience factor coming in, of knowing how to film something like Killer Eye, not the first one, the second one, or maybe the third one by David Dakota, and Final Stab in 4 days. And still, I'm still working on five-day movies for a full moon. But there's an interesting point here. I want to digress for a minute. I was the assistant editor on Malibu Express, which means I was in the editing room all the time. And Andy would come in and he would pass judgment on a scene that the editor was Craig, who was also the assistant camera person. So we knew all the shots. But in those days, we were editing on film, 35-millimeter film. And these were one-light dailies. That means they weren't entirely color-corrected. That would come from the lab. So we would be on a flatbed, six-plate steam deck, or an upright moviola, and cutting these scenes together. And this is how movies have been made in Hollywood for, 80 years. On an upright moviola, where you would come to your edit point, you'd figure out where the edit point was, you'd draw a China marker line, you'd take the film out of the moviola, you'd bring it over to your table, you'd cut it with a blade, you'd put the new piece of film on, you'd splice it together with tape, and you'd look at it. Okay, so each frame is 1/24th of a second. Let's call it a quarter of a second. Now, if you took one frame out too much, you could not put it back. Okay, the splicer could not splice one frame. So if you really needed it back, you'd have to call the lab and tell them you need a reprint of that scene. And you give them the scene number, the can number, and they'd go to the negative and make a print, and you'd get it 3 days later. So the genius of Andy, knowing when to make a cut and exactly where, maybe we'd be a little long first. And then he said, take two more frames. That shot needs a two-frame cut. And Andy could tell what a quarter of a second difference would make to the audience. And I carry that with me today when I'm watching a film. Many, many times I say, oh, wow, why didn't they make a two-frame cut? Why didn't they shorten that two frames? It would have made a huge difference. Okay, on to your questions.
Okay, one thing that brings up for me is, since you've been at this game for quite a while, can you tell us about some of the changes in technology and what they've added and maybe what we've lost because of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just going to go back to my opening where I said, I'll elaborate a little bit. It doesn't matter what kind of equipment you have. It's where you put the camera and why. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that little lens that the audience is going to relate to, that image, we can put it in more places now. We can move the camera a little bit more efficiently. But as far as technology, yes, the camera has an autofocus and an auto sensor and an auto this, auto that. And those are helpful, but to me, it sort of takes away from the purity of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Orson Welles shot with a camera that was the size of a refrigerator, right? And he couldn't even look through the lens. It was a non-reflex lens system where you had to look through a finder. But look at those compositions and look at the beauty of how he moves that camera as big as a refrigerator and how he tells the story. Yeah, nowadays you can make a camera, you make a movie with your iPhone or GoPro, and it's all there. But I think we're still missing the basics of filmmaking, where to put the camera and why. What are we telling the audience with this shot? I've evaded your question a little bit because I'm not. The technology is great. Yeah, the HMIs and LEDs now. You can go faster, quicker with a smaller package, a smaller truck, a smaller crew. All of that's true. It still comes down to what's on the page.
Yeah. Tom?
Sorry, I was just marking that off the list there.
Okay.
Okay, so I guess if I would have to say, I think it's the census, but Donna Spear would be the Sedaris girl. Do you have any stories about working with her or how she got involved or anything?
I don't know how she got involved. She was a playmate, and she was always awesome, always a team player. She and Hope got along really well. I'm sure there were cat fights in the makeup room that I wasn't privy to. It always happens, you know, but it didn't come out on set. I'm sure they had their off days. I'm sure, you know, they were sweating a little too much when they shouldn't have been. But we were all so close when you're filming a hot tub scene or a bedroom scene or in an airplane. You know, you get to know each other really closely. So, Donna is awesome. I have not read her book, but I know she's faced some obstacles in her life, but she was always a pleasure to work with. Everybody was awesome. I really like Roberta Vasquez.
Yeah.
She was great, especially on the back of a motorcycle. Lena Vertmiller, who's no longer with us, you know, she's got that iconic shot, which I think I have to take credit for, out at the racetrack where the camera is behind her butt a little bit. But that's, you know, that tells the story, doesn't it? Come on, guys. And she was awesome. She was terrific as Cody's girlfriend on the boat. She was always a lot of fun, a lot of energy, really great. One of the first movies, I forget which, I think it was Guns. In Guns in Las Vegas, all of a sudden standing next to me is, who's the guy, the bad guy in Guns with the face?
Danny Trejo?
Danny Trejo. Danny Trejo is standing next to me, and he hadn't done much film work until then.
This is like pretty soon after he got out of prison, right?
Pretty soon, that's right. And he still didn't really crack a smile when he was with other people. So there's a shot in Guns in the penthouse of the Rio Hotel where Danny Trejo is clenching his fist in the corner left side of the frame. And I think it works for the scene. I gave Danny that note as I'm looking up at him, standing, hovering over me. He still hadn't smiled yet. He hadn't said two words, but I'm crouched down low. It's a low angle looking up. And I said, "Sir, can you just react with your hand?" And he did. So I think he lightened up after that, or I think he split maybe. but I always have, to this day, I have a soft spot in my heart for Danny Trejo.
Yeah, he's a good dude.
Yeah.
Speaking of other actors, do you have any stories of Marcus Buff Bagwell from Return to Savage Beach?
Well, Marcus and his sidekick, right? Who's the sidekick?
Was it Lodi?
Marcus Bagwell.
He was the wrestler.
Marcus was the wrestler, yeah. I don't really have anything except I know Harold Diamond and him and Marcus worked together. Everybody was awesome. You know, everybody just wanted to please Andy. Andy was the kind of guy you would jump out of an airplane for. He was nice. The paychecks were on time. Craft service may not have been much, but we knew what we were doing. We weren't making Gone with the Wind. We were making an entertaining little piece that had some playmates in it, and they carried big guns on the beach. You know, so how seriously are we going to be about this? You know,
if you get the paychecks on time and they clear, that's all you can ask for.
And that was Arlene. Arlene was the money. She was the producer, and she carried the bag of checks or cash or whatever, jewels. And she was always saying, we're spending too much. This is costing too much. We can't afford it. We can't afford it. I'm not going to tell you what the budgets were back then, but they were pretty good. They were very comfortable. And not that the crew got that comfortable money, because crew never got good money on low-budget stuff. 40 years ago, we were just in it for the work, for the experience, for the art.
One of the names and faces that I was surprised to see upon rewatching these movies was Eric Estrada.
Eric, yeah.
What was that like?
Eric was awesome. Eric was tremendous. He brought the wife on the set, his two daughters who were maybe teenagers at the time, and he would tell stories about ships.
Mm-hmm.
Eric was great. I grew up watching Chips, so I was stoked to be in the same room with him. You know, he's kind of, wow, man, that's Eric Estrada over there. Holy moly. But then he'd sit next to you at lunch. You know, there wouldn't be if we had a catered lunch or occasionally, if we were on a set somewhere, we would have a crew table. Usually nowadays, there's a crew table and a cast table. Sedaris times, everybody ate as a family.
Hmm.
So Eric was awesome. I can't remember any specifics, but he was great.
Any stories or memories of Pat Morita?
Pat Morita was also awesome. I had done, I don't know if I had done a movie with him before or after, but I worked with Pat twice. And he was great. He was just a gentleman the entire time. And he wasn't there for his career necessarily. He was there for the art of acting.
Right on. I'm not sure about this one because once you watch all these movies in a row, it kind of melds together. Yeah. But did you do any shooting at the restaurant Cowboys? That was in, I think, Shreveport.
Yeah, that was in Louisiana. And I believe that's featured in Guns and The Dallas Connection, which I'm not certain you were on that one, were you?
I was not on Dallas Connection, Fit to Kill, or another one that Drew directed.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Morris. So Mark, great DP himself, he shot those three for Drew. You know, Cowboys could have been just a second unit establishing shot. That might not have been the same. That might have been a set or the hotel restaurant. I don't recall.
Gotcha. No worries.
So what's it like shooting puppets? Killer puppets.
Mm-hmm. Killer puppets. Well, it all comes down to the puppet. And you guys know Tom Devlin, who introduced us, and Tom and his 1313 effects crew are awesome. They really know how to puppeteer. The art of puppeteering has really sort of disappeared. I also worked on Howling Part 2. Steve Johnson was the bottle maker and the puppeteer at the same time, I believe. And when the rabid dog dies in a pool of tar or something, that was an extremely elaborate set. That was incredible, with three or four puppeteers. It wasn't animatronic. It was by wires back then. And today's puppets, you know, the eyes are animatronic for Full Moon, but some of them are wire controlled or string controlled from the exterior. And it takes sometimes two or three people, and we've had to sort of invent the puppeteer's monitor. So a puppeteer can see exactly what the shot is when they're laying on the ground upside down, backwards, trying to move the third leg.
That'd be helpful to have that for sure. I know I could have used that a few times.
A cool puppet. There's nothing like it. I don't know if Tom did all of the Puppet Masters. I came in, I think I shot Puppet Master 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a little more time, a little more money. Those were 35 millimeter. And once you go from video to 35 millimeter, there's a difference. There's a vibe on the set because you know that it's, wow, it's 33 cents a minute. And we only have 60 feet left on this 400-foot short end because we're shooting short ends. You know, so now with an endless memory, it's a little different. The discipline is different, and people get lazy when, you know, come on, we're running out of film. We got to get this.
It's all relaxed. We got it. There's four sticks in the case. Don't worry about it.
But you know, Tom, that new film students don't relate on that level anymore, because so much of shooting is on a card or a chip that with sort of long memory that you really don't have to worry about running out of footage. So that discipline is taken away by something else, which is time is money. Let's hurry up and get this. Let's hurry up. It doesn't matter. We'll fix it in post. You know, if the lighting's not right, I'll light it later. If the background's no good, okay, I'll take care of that later. You know, that kind of thing, which, you know, has to be accounted for because that's where we are in this creative art. And on the most recent Blade from John Lichago, distributed by Full Moon, one of the 10 deadly, that took almost a year in post for John to do little tweaks and fixes and work his magic. So a year is a long time to sit on a project.
Yeah.
One more little piece of trivia. Malibu Express, we worked on it so hard, and Andy was so proud of it. It was his first movie after 7. Where should we, and I'm in the editing room every day, which was the garage of a condo in Van Nuys. Andy did not want to edit in his house, so we got an editing set up in a condo with a kitchen. So we'd always have a ham and cheese sandwich. Andy could drive in his Corvette, 68 red convertible Corvette, down from his Beverly Hills home to check footage. And where should we premiere this? Where should we premiere this? Well, let's have an audience. See how it goes over with an audience. So somehow we decided on the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences on Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills. Well, we were too naive or too close to the picture to know that that was absolutely the wrong venue. It holds 2,000 people, right? And it's for Academy screening. And we had, somehow it got filled up to maybe there were 400 people there, friends of Andy's, other playmates. Hefner wouldn't come to that. He had a private screening at the Playboy Mansion. And we got the brand new print and we screened it. And Andy was so sick afterwards. He knew immediately when he walked in the room that it was the wrong place to show an Andy movie. Now, nowadays, with a little bit of, advertising, you might be able to fill the house and with a bar outside, and people could have fun watching a movie with a huge crowd, watching an Andy movie with a huge crowd. But back then, it went over like a lead balloon. So that was not a good moment.
I definitely think they found their audiences now. That's for sure.
Yeah, Tom Devlin hangs a sheet in his backyard and projects video of Andy movies. I was on location last year for another full moon picture that hasn't come out yet, Femalian. One of the crew gives me a homemade Andy Sedaris t-shirt that he made because he's a fan in Minneapolis of Andy movies. Hmm. Now that was pretty random for me to just receive. He knew that I had shot Andy movies and, I was kind of signing autographs on his DVD, but he gives me a t-shirt that he made for the audience. Wow. What a trip. And I know, I see it on the website, I see the chatter, and there's a lot of people get it and some don't, but that's okay. There's still, the male and female audience who loves these movies, and I have to say after 40 years that I got the exposure right 99% of the time. So I take credit for that. I take credit for how they look now in remastered to HD. I mean, that's got to be based on the original footage that we shot without a video tap that I have an old Spectra light meter with a silly O'Connor 50 head on the tripod that really you couldn't do much with. But we got the footage and made a movie out of it. And 40 years later, you're doing an interview with me. That's incredible. That's so awesome, for the audience. That's great. And I thank you, Tom. And
no, you and thank you
for doing this.
No, this has been fun. And it's weeks, months at this time, but we just got this box set as a goof. I heard a hard ticket from our hard ticket to Hawaii and Malibu Express before. But then Joe's just like, hey, you know what? I think I have this set too. So each week we've just been going along watching each one of these movies and then talking about them.
That's cool. Yeah, there was a 12-box set, I think, that sold at Walmart. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one we have. And I had seen maybe 3 or 4 of them because they used to air on Cinemax After Dark in the 90s. So, yeah, so some of these were just films that I'd revisited, and, yeah, these women are just drop-dead gorgeous for the most part. For the most part. But this is the last question that I have listed on my list, and you've mentioned Orson Welles a couple of times. I was wondering who are some of the other influences you've had in as cinematographers, who is somebody that you can't watch enough of?
Well, first off the top is Roger Deakins, probably on everybody's list since he got the award for 1917 last year. But any Deakins movie you can look at and study. There are others. Almost any cinematographer in the 50s, in the 60s, because I know what equipment they had to work with, you know, and it wasn't electronic at all. And telling a story, Spielberg does great, fantastic work with his staging. And he's had three or four cinematographers who are all awesome, does great work. Vilmos, Zsigmond, incredible work, very taking chances all the time. It's really the combination of a director and a DP. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes, occasionally that doesn't work. There's friction, or somebody, one of the two, is not having a good time. But most of the time it's a collaboration, right? So you got to have the technology in place, but, or the lack of technology in place, but you also have to have the, well, let me put it this way. When people ask me they should learn to be a cinematographer, I say psychology. You got to know how to talk to people in a way that's non-offensive. You got to be able to move a crew without pissing people off. You got to be able to wait to tell the director the sun's going down, or you have 30 feet left in the magazine. There's a lot of psychology behind the image that comes with a crew member in any department, really, but cinematography being up there, being really close to the director in terms of capturing the story. There are many, many DPs that I like. Grant Tolan and Orson Welles, what those guys did, they invented our genre, not our genre, they invented our, you know, how we make movies, just by showing us what could be done. And nowadays we're doing the same thing. We're doing it in a different way. We're putting the camera in new places. We're telling the story differently. We're going backwards and forwards. You know, we're even episodic television is something to watch, because there's so much new ground. Games of Thrones makes such new headway. And that movie that's shot in the South, that's so dark, the HBO episode, everybody's complaining they can't see it. It's too dark, too dark. Well, an automatic sensor would not make it dark. So that's a conscious decision by the production team. Let's make this a dark image. The story is dark. We need the audience to sort of work harder to see what's going on. That's about all I have to share on the DPs.
Cool. Thanks.
All right. Well, I did solicit a few questions from listeners, if you don't mind taking those, and then I think we can wrap this up.
Okay, man.
All right. This first one is a little stiff, so if you don't want to answer it, that is totally okay, and I am going to read it how it was sent to me.
I'm on the phone for a moment. Excuse me. Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
I would just like to hear what you has to say, what it is like working with Charles Band. I have heard the stories from Sid Haig, Bill Moseley, Jeff Burr, John Carl Beekler. I would just wonder if they are the same as theirs. Simply, Band works on a shitload of projects and hopes to get one a month done and doesn't pay for shit or get paid up front when working for him. LOL. Tim Gross of Gross Movie Reviews.
Okay, Tim. Well, Charlie is a genius. And I almost just want to stop there, because geniuses are allowed to be geniuses. I've been working for Charlie for 20 years. And yes, 30 years ago, it was hard to get a check that was good. Even though I loved working there and I was shooting film and learning and making 35mm features. But Charlie always reinvents himself. And I think what Sid Haig and those other guys are talking about is an old Charlie. Yes, he's working on many projects. And because of, you know, pandemic, we couldn't do the 10 deadly in the order that we wanted to. And one or two of them were taking a little longer than before. And Lindsay, who's directing Chameleon, sort of a first-time director. So there's a fair amount of politics. But Charlie is awesome. He pays fairly. I'll just put it that way. He pays fairly. He, working with him, he's directed a couple of Bong movies that I've shot. Charlie never has script notes. It's by the seat of his pants. He knows exactly how it's going to edit. He can anticipate things. He takes suggestions. Oftentimes, I've saved his ass by saying, "Oh, we need to get this reversed before we wrap." He's appreciative to me for remembering that we needed that shot. So, you know, working for Charlie is like going to school. Also, is the same as Sedaris, and that's why they're sort of in the same club. They're filmmakers in their own right. They're smart. They're intelligent. They know what they want. Sometimes it's hard to get because of time, money, or personnel. But you know, he's made what, 350 something movies. So that's more than I have. More than most people. You got to credit him for that.
Yeah.
Sounds fair to me.
And Charlie's brother, Richard, does fantastic music. Just incredible themes and music. And there was a Puppet Master 2 ago about the Nazi Puppet Master that has such nuanced music by Richard Band. It's an incredible looking movie. It didn't get great reviews for whatever reason. But if you watch it silently, I think it's a beautiful film. We shot it all in 7 days, in 5 days, in one location, downtown Los Angeles, in a warehouse. But I think between me and Jeff Jones, the colorist, who did a fantastic job. And that's not even 4K. That was shot HD on the 10-year-old camera that Film Moon owns. We just rent lenses for it. So, you know, it's not the camera that's going to make a difference. It wasn't shot on Red or Alexa. It's a full-censored Sony X100, sort of the first box camera that came out. So Charlie learned from his father, who made a lot of movies in Italy, and Charlie was on the set all the time. And then he just loves film, man. You can see by his releases that he loves every kind of genre, and I really enjoy working with Charlie because he's challenging, and that's what every artist wants, to be challenged. I want to dig deeper. I don't want to do the same old, same old. I want this shot somehow, or this movie, or this scene. Challenge me, Charlie. Tell me what you really want, and I'll tell you if we can do it in the next 5 minutes or not. You know, so there's a give and take working with Andy, and the same with Charlie. Right. I hope that answers his question.
Yeah, I think he got more than he wanted, so thank you.
Okay. This next question comes to us from Chris Holmes of Conspiratheory Podcast. He asks, "I'm a big fan of the Invisible Chronicles. Do you have any fun stories to share about the boys on the set?"
I'm not sure I worked on that one.
Okay, there's your answer, Chris. Better luck next time.
Unless it changed titles or something else, but The Invisible Man, I think, was a David Dakota movie for a minute. I can't answer that question. I'm sorry, guys.
Okay,
no worries.
No problem.
Thanks, Chris. This one is from Albert Wesker. I love Double Impact. Is Jean-Claude Van Damme a cool dude?
Okay, so I was second unit on Double Impact. I shot the opening scene where Van Damme is in a convertible, I believe, driving through Hong Kong. And that was shot on a soundstage in Chatsworth in 35 millimeter with a Mitchell camera that was slaved to a rear projection camera. In those days, it was film projected on a screen behind the actor. And my camera, or the A camera, is filming the actor and also seeing the rear screen projection, which was downtown Hong Kong. And so, yes, Van Damme was awesome to work with. He was a very nice man. He knew he was in perhaps going to be a fairly successful movie. That scene was lit very interestingly by me and my gaffer. I have a small crew on this kind of stuff. It's me, a camera assistant, maybe one or two other people. But we built what we called a Christmas tree, which was rigged out of grip stands and things. And we had multicolored lights on four arms of this. And this rotated above the car that Van Damme was in. So the reflections on the windshield and the light that was coming into the car was strictly movie lights coming from above and maybe a little from the side on a manually operated sort of a pole that had four legs on it. So, and I've used that technique several other times. I did a movie called Angel Part 3 with Maude Adams. She's in the back seat of a limo and the camera was in the car and she's driving somewhere. And I rigged up lights to blink on and off as the car was driving down sort of a dark road. We did the same thing in Ouija's, which was a Danny Draven Full Moon film, came out last Halloween, where the couple is driving down the streets of Las Vegas. And I had three PAs turning on and off lights as the car is sitting in a parking lot with a black backdrop in a hotel in Las Vegas. And that cuts in seamlessly with the point of view shots of Las Tropicana Boulevard or Las Vegas Boulevard. And you see the lights play on the couple as they're driving. So the Van Damme was awesome to work with. I was second unit for a lot of that picture, which was on a old World War II ship in San Pedro, California. And I should mention also at this point that I am not related to Academy Award-winning cinematographer Haskell Wexler. Haskell was a family friend, as well as Conrad Hall was a family friend. Because my dad sort of came from the same era and knew those guys. And my dad made medical educational films in a little studio in Hollywood, and I kind of grew up around there. And Haskell would come over for dinner sometimes, and Conrad Hall was a family friend. And as a matter of fact, I decided to be a cinematographer when we came out of, I was about 9 or 10, I came out of a movie called The Professionals with Lee Marvin. Woody Strode, and just a Richard Brooks film, a Western. And I came out of there and I knew that Conrad Hall was the cinematographer for that movie. And his camera operator was Bill Fraker, another person that I really got to meet later who was awesome. And we got home and I said, I want to be a cinematographer. And they immediately called up Haskell. And my mom said, Haskell, Howard said he wants to be a cinematographer. And Haskell said, that's great, but can he spell it? That's the end of my story.
Well, speaking of other Wexlers, you share a name with Howard Wexler, the creator of Connect 4, the game.
Of Connect 4, that's right.
So, but how's your Connect 4 game? You pretty good?
Oh, it was when I was growing up, and fortunately, I got the website address before he did. Yeah, Connect 4 is an awesome game. I hear Howard Wexler in Chicago is a very nice man.
Well, unfortunately, there's another question from Chris Holmes, so let's see how this one goes. Could you also ask about the Brotherhood movies? I really like those as well.
Awesome. Well, the Brotherhood movies are really come from David Dakota, the director. And those are 4 and 5 day movies. I haven't shot one in a while. David sort of moved on, and they're not distributed by Full Moon, I don't think, anymore. The previous ones are. But David does not have notes as a director, and he does everything in his head. He doesn't take lunch. He's studying the script. So when he first comes to set, he's studying the script. During lunch, he's studying the script. So he knows exactly what needs to be done during our shoot. And those movies were a lot of fun. You know, the actors, yes, they knew their lines. That's an adamant request from David. Better know your lines before you come to set. Sometimes the actors in the Brotherhood movies had lengthy paragraphs, and all those guys knew their lines. So a testament to David and, you know, casting well and getting performances.
I've never heard of this. Is it like some kind of werewolf movie or something?
It's a vampire movie, I believe.
Oh, that makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, and some of them are quite elaborate with their plot structure and the way the actors relate to each other.
All right.
Next question is from Rusty. How was it working with James Urbaniak?
Urbaniak.
Urbaniak, there you go.
Mm-hmm. That was a David Avalone project. And interestingly enough, David Avalone wrote some of the treatments for Andy Sedaris. Huh. David's a friend of mine. He was an editor for many years. He was close with Andy and Arlene. He was an advisor to them. He's now doing comic books with Elvira. And he's doing some work with the guy who invented the Turtles.
Kevin Eastman,
who was also married to
Julie Strain
was in an Andy movie.
It all comes back to Sedaris, huh?
Doesn't it? Isn't it amazing how there's only 12 people in the world? And you know, by the way, Julie was awesome. Kevin was really in the that was back in the highlight days of Turtles, Turtles. And we were in the backyard of Kevin's house, and they were married at the time, and Julie was in perfect health then, and she was awesome. She sits in a big chair in a scene, I think, or another actor does. Julie was awesome. Julie was great. But Urbaniak is a close friend of David Avalone, and he was a very nice man, competent, professional. Very good ad libbing. I didn't interact too much with him. Both shoots I was on with him took an hour, you know, because we worked fast.
Right on.
So, I hope that answers his question.
Yeah, I think he was asking because he's a Venture Brothers fan and he does one of the voices for it. I have James Urbaniak, I'm familiar with.
Okay.
And Joe, we got. One more, two more? What do you have?
One more. And it's our standard closing question for interviews. And we just want to know what your favorite ice cream is.
Coffee ice cream. Without hesitation.
Great selection.
Coffee ice cream. And I would go for the Häagen-Dazs coffee.
I am also a fan.
I don't drink coffee, you know, because as a camera operator, if you get the shake, you can't operate, you know, and coffee, even more than half a cup, my hands start to twitch a little bit. So I don't drink coffee because you can't operate a damn camera. But I love coffee ice cream.
Same here. Never touch coffee, but the ice cream is pretty good.
Okay, then we can party together.
Yeah, I right love both. No, I just want to thank you for coming on. And
Joe, before we do that, I do have one more question on here.
All right.
And it is from J. Jonah Jerklin, and he wants to know, can you get him pictures of Spider-Man?
Ooh.
And now, how would I know about Spider-Man? I don't accept, you know, you could Google that. Or you can go to a virtual convention. You can come to North Hollywood and go to the bookstore. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer than that.
Well, that's okay. But we do thank you for coming on and having some fun with us. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, guys, Joe and Tom, thank you for letting me freeform here for a while, but I hadn't done this about Sidaris ever, so it was good.
Wow.
And by the way, one last closing comment. I keep calling Arlene once a year to tell her the world needs another Sidaris movie. And, you know, the model of the Cessna is hanging in her living room. And that's the same model that's in the movie. And she still has some of the props. And if one of the girls, if Hope Marie or Donna Spear had a daughter, the daughter would take over the business and become Molokai Cargo.
You could have, more Lethal Ladies films, the next generation.
That's exactly right. And I wouldn't mind even shooting that in high def. And we could have a memory chip and automatic focus and all that stuff.
You and, make it, we'll watch it.
Definitely.
Okay. And, you know, they're still going to take showers every 10 minutes or every 5 minutes.
You got to stay clean.
That's right. It's hot out at those islands.
That's right. I'm working on Arlene every year. So I know that there's an audience and you guys are contributing to that. And even if it's a GoFundMe, as Charlie has done with a couple of his movies, and people have paid big bucks to be killed in a Charlie movie and have blood all over themselves, I know there's an audience. So one of these days, hopefully, there'll be another Molokai Cargo movie.
Right on. If there's anything we can do to try and help get it made, let us know.
Okay, guys. Well, thanks again for the opportunity. Call me again if there's any other questions. Somebody, you could give out my personal info if somebody really wants.
It's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Do you have anything you want to promote?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not promoting anything except myself. DPing is what I do. I'm trying to get my own projects off the ground, but I love working on movies and helping directors, young and old, sort of capture their vision. So anybody out there, I'm negotiable.
Right on.
Okay. All right.
Cool. Guys. Well, again, appreciate it for sure. And it was fun talking to you. Hope you had an all right time too.
I had a great time. Awesome. Tremendous.
Well, right on, man. You try and enjoy the rest of your day and take it easy with all this shit going on, you know?
I will. And we're friends now. We'll stay in touch.
Right on, man.
You take care.
All right, Joe. Thank you. You too, man. Thank you. Thanks.
Bye. Right on. Later.
Well,
that was a fucking interview, wasn't it? Wasn't expecting it to go that long, but I'm thankful and grateful that it did. I was thinking maybe go for about an hour. That's why it broke in. Or so, oh, we got to do anything. We can get more time, please. But, you know, we did it and we got it done. A couple jokes thrown in there, but all in all, pretty straightforward interview about the Andy Sedaris movies and a little about Howard and his career as well. I want to thank Tom Devlin for setting up this interview. You could check him out at, I guess just go to Tom Devlin's Monster Museum in Boulder City, Nevada. It's in Nevada. I know that for sure. So if you were in Nevada or Nevada, however the fuck you're supposed to pronounce it, go to Tom Devlin's Monster Museum. He's got a bunch of cool shit in there. He also offers classes and just a lot of cool stuff to look at, especially if you're into full moon movies. I think it was pretty obvious by the interview and the lack of full moon questions that neither Joe or I really are, but that's okay. You still can be, and you can still see props at Tom Devlin's Monster Museum, unless you're listening. I was going to say reading this like an asshole, but hey, maybe you are reading this in the year 3000, but by that time, unfortunately, I think the museum will be closed for business. Anyways, if you want to get in contact with Howard, find him on Facebook, Howard Wexler. Otherwise, HowWex, HOWWEX@gmail.com. Hit him up if you need something shot in the Los Angeles area. Get at him. As he said, he'll hook you up with a fair and decent price. I think flexible was the word he used. Take that as you will. But again, Howard, appreciate you coming on and shooting the shit with us for, nearly 2 hours. That was real cool of you. And everybody else, remember, FastCustomShirts.com for all your t-shirt needs. And DWNProductions.net to see my art and movies and what have you. Well, see you next week. Hopefully it was, I know the episode that we dropped before this one wasn't great, but hey, we're working on that. Maybe next week will be a little better. But regardless, you got this one, and it was pretty good. So again, Howard, thank you. Tom, thank you. Not me. Devlin. Joe, thank you. Fast Custom Shirts. DWNProductions.net. BoyGob.com. And just...